What is going on, everyone? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. This is episode 30. I cannot believe it. Episode 30 is here, and I am talking to Christina. Christina is a person that wears a lot of hats. The reason we connected is I found her on Instagram, and she does a lot of work right now. She's doing a fellowship on faith and work, and so she has that going on. She also does a lot of work around research around ending human trafficking, and we talk about that in this episode. She has a lot of great insight into that. Christina's also a mom, and I think talking about moms and work is a complicated discussion. It's one of those, especially in the church, that's very volatile, and there's a lot of shame around either working or not working for women sometimes with kids. And so we talk about her journey in being a mom. Oh yeah, and she balances all that while teaching at Baylor University, which is a place I have some familiarity with. And so we talk about what it's like to be a teacher, especially one who's interdisciplinary like she is, between the English world and the leadership world. There's just so much here to cover, for sure. This is such a great episode, y'all. I cannot wait for you to hear it. She is just really well-spoken, really was well thought out, and she makes a mistake towards the end a little bit, however, which is asking me about the podcast, which launches me onto a huge tangent about what the theology of hustle is and why I'm doing it and some of the philosophy behind it. I think maybe she got more than she bargained for with that question, but she was very gracious with me and let me talk about it. And I felt like, you know, we're 30 episodes in, there's people that haven't listened from the beginning. And so it's important to sort of talk about what I'm doing here and what the whole point of all of this is. And so you get a lot of that in this episode. So yeah, I really hope you enjoy this episode. Listen, share it. Make sure you're subscribed and leave me a review in your podcast app if you can. If you enjoyed the episode, I would greatly appreciate it. Yeah, this is a fun episode, and I can't wait for you to hear it. It's topics that we haven't even covered yet, which is really cool, and I think you're gonna enjoy. So I hope you enjoy this episode with Christina. All right. Well, Christina, hi. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
This is awesome. Yeah, I've you're at Baylor right now. Like, you live in Waco, right?
I do. Waco, Texas.
I really like Waco. I have in-laws that went to Baylor, so okay. You know, I get the whole Baylor thing, you know.
Yeah. It's good. Yeah. Yeah. My husband and I actually went to Texas A&M for undergrad, and we did our graduate degrees at Baylor. So, I don't know if Baylor feels that we're as Baylor as we try to say that we are.
Yeah, it sounds like you might get yourself into some awkward situations there. I mean, Aggies and Bears hanging
out.
Yeah,
and Baylor, you know. Bears. I know. It can get a little awkward sometimes, but they're not in the same conference anymore. So I think that takes a little bit of the rivalry out.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let's jump off by just having people sort of, why don't you tell us your story?
Okay, sure. I think maybe even starting with, it seems like undergrad is a great place to start and good transition from talking about colleges. My husband and I met at Texas A&M. I was in a coffee shop studying Spanish, and he was picking me up by asking me my phone number. So he says he has never done that before, but it worked for him that time. We've been together since undergrad, married for 15 years. After we both graduated, we moved to Boston, and I worked as a high school English teacher in a small private Christian school. And then when we were ready to move back to Texas, we thought we were ready to start a family. We chose Waco in part because we had some community here, but then also so he could do his MBA at Baylor and I could do my PhD at Baylor. So that was how we got to Waco the first time. Once we finished our graduate degrees, we went to California, and I taught as an assistant professor at California Baptist University, and he worked in the business world. So once we were ready to start a family, we thought we were the first time, and the Lord had other plans. We moved back to Waco, and we've been here for 4 years.
Okay, awesome. Yeah. So what is your PhD in then?
Yeah, so it's basically English education. It's a PhD in curriculum and instruction. And then within that PhD, within those 72 hours, 18 of them are dedicated to similar to what we'd call, you know, like a minor, but it's a cognate, so an area of focus. And mine is English. So I have historically taught at California Baptist University and Baylor in between the English department and the School of Education. So a lot of teacher candidates. But in the English department, I teach, I mean, they're coming from business, engineering, you know, STEM fields, they're coming from all over. And then within the education department, I've taught leadership courses, like educational leadership, and then also some English education classes.
Wow. Okay. So how did you decide to go down that route then?
Yeah. You know, I come from a long line of educators. My uncle right now is a dean of a university up in the Fort Worth area. My other uncle is a professor down at a university in Austin. And then my mom has a master's degree in English. So I don't know that I had a vision to grow up and be a professor, but I have always cultivated a love for learning and a love for education just has been part of my family line. So it wasn't surprising, I think, when I did a PhD program and really thought I would become a mom first. And had, we were trying the entire time during my program to start a family and the Lord had other plans for us. It took us 4 years and a couple of rounds of infertility treatment to become parents. So in that time, I just happened to accumulate more degrees during that. Yeah, why not? But I do think in retrospect, that was the sovereignty of the Lord, because I don't know that it's just so hard to do anything as a mother. And trying to do a PhD program as a mom, it's not impossible, but it is difficult. So that I was able to finish and started having children right at the tail end, kind of writing the dissertation, I think really was providential.
No kidding. I cannot imagine going back for a PhD after you have littles running around the house, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So do you mind if we jump off with that, with being a mom and
sure,
hustling?
Absolutely. Yeah, it is. It's a hustle. It's a grind being a mom, for sure.
Well, and you do so many different things, it seems like. How have you sort of processed what work looks like as a mother, especially with, you know, you still have relatively small children.
Yeah. Yeah. They're 5 and 6 and they're only 20 months apart. So there's that time period when they're like, seems like they're only a year apart, 5 and 6. You know, I think every season is really just pausing to discern. I'll even do sort of a spiritual retreat where I'll take 2 days. My husband lets me use his hotel points and I go off and spend, you know, kind of 2 days praying and asking the Lord, what about this next season or next opportunity? But sort of backing up to when I first became a mom, I was on a tenure track and was an assistant professor at California Baptist University and felt really great about where I was when I had one child. You know, one is always easier than 2, 3, 4. And there's a term for that and within sort of feminist movement called the baby penalty. And if you look at the data, it doesn't affect men as much. There's no adverse statistic for men having children. In fact, sometimes that can actually even benefit them. But for women, this baby penalty, every time you have a baby, it really sets you back a couple of years, a couple of pay raises, a couple of climbs on the corporate ladder. So I sort of knew that going into it, but wanted to navigate that well and did not necessarily want to step away from a tenure track assistant professor position. But at the end of the day, felt like that's what the Lord was saying. And that was a hard place of obedience, a really difficult place of obedience. In the natural, it did not make sense. Nobody really, nobody does that. To this day, I have not met anybody else who's done that. I met one gal who went from being an assistant professor to a lecturer to have more wiggle room to be a mother. But it was a tough decision. But I think I realized some logistical factors, like I just don't know that I wanted to be tenured out in California. It wasn't where we're called long term. So there's that. At any given day, my husband could have been in Canada or on the East Coast traveling for work. And that left the burden of taking care of doctor's appointments or if they got sick at school or if the nanny canceled on me. And that was a lot of pressure. So I just had to trust the Lord when he said, if you will release this and you will, you know, walk this out open-handedly, then I will return this in a way that you couldn't have foreseen. And so that's been a pretty true promise. I haven't it hasn't come to fruition the way that I thought I would, but it has been better. It honestly has been better than what I had dreamed for my own work life. So that was sort of the beginning of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So because this is such a big topic, and I think a really important topic that we as Christians don't talk about enough in the vocational world, because when my wife had her first kid, she had to like step away from her job. I mean, it just wasn't even feasible for her to continue on that job. And she like was the breadwinner. You know what I mean?
It's hard.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's so, and I think in our little Christian sphere, there can be so much guilt and like shame around working and not working. How do we talk about that?
Yeah. I think the first place to start to sort of baseline is that there is no one right answer or right formula for families. I have friends, a few friends of mine are physicians, and they're the primary breadwinner, and they work, you know, 30, 40, 50 hours a week. Each one is a little different, and their husbands work, but it really is in more of a support career that allows them to be the breadwinner and to be the primary employee, I guess, in the family. They're gone the most. And, you know, I think again, within church circles, that seems odd. It's becoming more normalized, but when they were going through medical school 10 years ago, I think they wrestled through, can I do this? Is this sort of antithetical to what my church has taught me? Is this heresy within what scripture has said? And I think it's really noting that place that men and women are both created to work and to co-labor. It just looks differently. So historically, women have worked, but within the home, but no one is going to say that that work isn't valid and that it isn't hard. That is hard work. So it is still work. I think where it just becomes there's a little bit of a tension around it is when we start tying paychecks to it. And I think that's something that we've gotten better within the church of walking out theologically. Like, why then does it change if I'm at home working all day doing domestic, you know, things versus if I'm out for 10, 15, 20 hours a week doing something that is tied to a paycheck? Why then does that become a sticky conversation? And so I think theologically as a church, as a community, we've gotten better and gotten a more robust language around this. But it is going back to every family is going to be different, and you have to do what is best for your family. And I constantly go back to that place, is my husband able to do what he's called to do, or is my career getting in the way? And then how do we reconcile that? Are my kids thriving, or do they need me to step away a little bit more? And how do I reconcile that? So knowing that I'm called to work, but then sort of open-handedly saying, okay, well, Lord, what do you have me to steward in this season? And when my kids were younger, I stewarded a lot less. I taught just part-time. I helped an anti-human trafficking organization with their curriculum. And I did a little bit of writing and publishing. As they got a little older and they went to more childcare, I took on a little bit more responsibility. And this is actually my second year to be full-time again. So it really wasn't until my kids were like 3 and 4 that I felt like, okay, they can handle going to childcare. I mean, like a little preschool from 8 to 3. And, you know, as they get older, I think there's more that we can handle as a family, but every family is going to be different. Your kids have needs. That's important. But then also just being very open-handed, Lord, what are you saying for our family?
Yeah. It feels like it's a bit of a dance for all of us, right? We all have to sort of different seasons, right? When they're babies and, you know, maybe get a little bit older. Yeah, for sure. No, I appreciate you talking a little bit about that. That can be tricky stuff.
It can be, yes.
Right.
Well, I was going to say, and we love for it. We want formulas. At least I do. I don't know. I'm high J on the Myers-Briggs. So I'm like, what is the formula? What's going to work? What can I just apply and implement to every season of life? But the kingdom doesn't work that way, right? I mean, scripture talks so much about seasons and change. And so I think we have to be willing to live within that as well. And to know that just because I've had this great model for 2 years, that doesn't mean that that's going to work the next 2 years. And being, I think, open to those seasons of change and just discerning what is this season. But inevitably, there are seasons. And it does seem that women have to navigate that a little bit more than men. I think that is probably fair to say.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I love that word from you about seasons. And yeah, because we do. We're like, we like our laws, even though we don't think we do. We really like, there's comfort in that, right? Like if you just do A, B, and C, you're good to go.
Yes. Right? Yeah.
Life, that's not life, and that's not Christianity that right. I've ever known.
Right.
It
to that's be, right? true. Yeah.
That's good. I appreciate that. That's good stuff. Yes, and I do agree. Like, I stay home probably 30 hours a week, you know, with mm-hmm. my kids, and mm-hmm. I have a job that lets me stay home. Yes. You know, and you just yeah. kind of do it, right?
Right?
Like, I go to mom's groups and hang out at
that's
Chick-fil-A,
awesome.
Right?
That's awesome. I love that. Yeah. And again, I have several male friends, and that is what they're doing with their kids while their wives are, you know, physicians or doing whatever else they're called to do. And I think just being willing to navigate that, and, you know, if that's what the Lord is saying for your family, then that's your rock to stand on. That's, yeah,
yeah. Totally. Totally. Keeping it open-handed. Mm-hmm. So how do we approach your jobs here? You do
all
so
my
many
hustles,
different things,
all
right?
The
you do. I resonate with you because yeah. I'm very much the same way.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I get it. Uh-huh. So what do you want to sort of jump into first? I think the human anti-human trafficking thing sort of the, I mean, maybe something that like something that you've done for a long period of time, or
say by long, it's been 5 years. So maybe, okay. maybe that yeah. is long by millennial standards these days. Yeah. You know, I sort of joke with people that what I teach are English classes, some leadership classes, but what I do is really anti-human trafficking research. It's sort of a long, convoluted story as to how I got involved in that. But the short version is I went on a maternity leave of sorts in California, and relationship through this church that we had gone to in Waco, and then the kind of probably the Hillsong movement, there was an organization, the A21 campaign, that needed help with their curriculum. And since my PhD is in curriculum, and I did have at least an interest in a heart for ending human trafficking, very few people who encounter this as a political point or discussion point don't find that they too feel, you know, attracted to combating it. It's just such an egregious example of modern day slavery. So I think a lot of people who learn about it, I've seen this to be true with my students, then ask, how can I get involved in combating it? How can I use my sphere of influence to combat it? So if you're in business, it may be supporting other human trafficking organizations or looking for ways to help them with their marketing. If you're in education, as I am, it may be prevention awareness. If you're in law, some friends of mine will do some pro bono cases for people who have been rescued out of trafficking. So situations like that. So I did the curriculum, wrapped that up, and moved back to Texas. Sort of thought that I would be done with that. And at that time, the woman who ran the organization, Christine Kane, then launched this Propel Women's Leadership movement. I want to represent it fairly, but I think she has openly said back in the day that this is sort of the Christian rebuttal response to the Lean In movement. Not that there's anything inherently wrong with Lean In, it just does not give us the full holistic Christian worldview picture. So we would find ourselves in these rooms, you know, Christine and other people who were on the brain trust at the time, asking questions like, why would I lean in? Why would I fight for a seat at the table? Why would I fight for the corner office? Things that the book asks you to do, make my partner an equal co-partner in work, unless I really knew that this is what God was calling me to do, because it's hard. It is hard to do children and to do women's leadership and to lean in if you don't really feel like you're called to do that. So I think the first place of starting was, what are you called to do? How do you steward that? How do you see yourself as a leader, whether you're home all day or you're in ministry or you're out in the workplace? Because as we know, as Christians, we are called to lead, to be salt and light. And that is something really unique to the Christian narrative that, you know, sort of the secular conversation can't own or claim. You may be using influence from or platform from, you know, your place of work, but we're actually doing it from a place of faith, from a place of, you know, reconciling people to Christ. So it was this opportunity to be part of this women's leadership movement that I connected to through the A21 campaign, but stayed involved doing human trafficking work. And now I've worked with other organizations. And I think that's nice about not being attached to just one, that I've been able to do the research through Baylor on the curriculum. I have spoken with Freedom Climb, which is a human trafficking organization that climbs mountains to raise money for human trafficking and Unbound, which is located here in Waco, but has global reach. So I think I just, you know, I was connected at the heart to that issue and have just asked, okay, how can I use my sphere of influence to contribute to combating this?
Yeah. Wow. That's awesome. Such a big need. Let's talk a little bit just about that. I mean, how do you sort of walk people through that process of using their sphere of influence? And
Yeah. So specifically with leadership, because I think I do that with leadership and then also with human trafficking, with leadership, it really is just changing the mindset, the perspective of people, and helping them see, you know, if you're volunteering with MOPS and you're the leader of a table, MOPS is that, was it Mothers of Preschoolers? I don't know what the S stands for. Maybe that's preschoolers. But MOPS, you know, the International Moms Group, it's helping women see that, you know, if you're raising 4 and 5 year olds and you've got somebody at your table who's got toddlers and you know what it's like to be in the trenches, then intentionally reaching out, discipling, loving on that mom, kind of leading her to a place of flourishing, that is still leadership. You still have influence. You know, because we don't really need the analogies and the examples for the people who are in high level leadership positions. We know you have influence. We know you have leadership. I think it's really empowering people to see within even your sphere of influence, no matter how small, you still have influence. How are you stewarding that? Because that's what you're going to be held accountable for at the end of the day. I think I'd even kind of talked about that on Instagram the other day. That no, you know, at the end of the day, we're not going to be accountable for how much money we made or how many hours we worked, but how we stewarded what God gave us. And part of that is stewarding your sphere of influence. So I think from a leadership perspective, that's sort of stewarding that. And then with human trafficking, I always do a big human trafficking unit with my students, a writing unit or a leadership unit, depending on the class I'm teaching, because my hope is that they will then go off to become nurses who look for signs of victims, or businessmen who look for ways to really support organizations doing this, or social workers who want to lend their trade to doing rehabilitation. That whatever it is that God's going to call them to do after they take my class, that they still have a part that they can play and ushering in kingdom-minded justice. So if it's not human trafficking, hopefully it is something else that they're able to play a part of, that kingdom reconciliation of taking what has been fallen and then, you know, bringing it to a place of redemption, restoration, you know, to co-labor with God in doing that.
Yeah, no, that's great stuff. I love that. I mean, human trafficking is this thing that I think is getting so much more airplay, right? People are just realizing the need so much more these days. But it always, to me, feels like an other world problem, like a majority world problem, right? Something that happens to other people, other places. But can you speak a little bit to just even like how, like us living here in America, like what that means for us and,
Yeah. And you know, the numbers on it are so hard to pin down because very few people come forward and say, you know, I'm a victim or I'm a pimp that we would typically call a John within human trafficking vernacular. But I think some things that we know that there's an estimated, you know, between 30 and 40 million people who are trapped in trafficking globally. And that includes, you know, things from sex trafficking to labor trafficking to even child soldiers. This is a small fraction of what comprises human trafficking, but organ trafficking and orphan trafficking are part of the problem. And then domestically, we used to say, we would use these numbers from the Polaris Project, which are typically the most accurate. And we would say about 100, 150,000 people are trafficked into the U.S. every year. And those are particularly coming from the southern borders. Texas is a southern border state, California. Texas, we do know, is the second most trafficked state in America. California is the first. Part of that is population. Most of that is border. Houston is the most trafficked city in America, again, because of the demographics and because we've got 2 international airports. We have international, you know, freeways, or not really, you know, domestic freeways that go across America. So that's part of the problem. There was a study that came out in 2016 from the University of Texas that really, I think, turned a lot of the stats you were using on their head, because they estimated that 79,000 people in Texas are victims of human trafficking. And that is almost the stat we were using for, you know, the U.S. I mean, it's like half what we're using. So we know that it's got to be more and that it's underreported. students will always say, where did this come from? Why now? And I think that you were right to say this is not a new issue. It is just getting attention. Partly the internet has made it easier to buy mostly women and children. Men are definitely exploited too, particularly through labor trafficking. But we can now get online and order a person just like we would a pizza or an Amazon shipment. And that is new to the trafficking movement. Prostitution, sex trafficking, human trafficking has always, since the beginning of time, been a problem. But this is the first time, the last 10, 15 years, that you could actually start selling or watching people through the internet. So there are places, I mean, you, I'm sure, have had to wrestle through, you know, good use of technology and bad use of technology. And I would say this podcast is a great example of good use, but then trafficking people through online channels is obviously a really terrible, egregious use of technology. So,
yeah. That is staggering.
It is staggering.
Golly.
But there's hope in that. I like to tell people that there's always hope in the place of redemption and restoration. I cannot bring myself to be involved in issues where it feels hopeless. And I've been so encouraged by the way the church has gathered around human trafficking, this issue, much like the orphan crisis or, you know, other things, you know, the life movement, things like that, where the church has really risen up and said, hey, this is a biblical issue and we need to be a part of this justice. And I think human trafficking is one of those places where the church has risen up and said, wow, this is a problem. How can we play a part in faith-based justice here?
Yeah, no, I think, man, if our faith does not compel us to bring people out of slavery, then what are we doing with it, right?
I mean, right, that's a good point.
You brought up a term, though, I'd never really heard of. Do you mind explaining a little more about orphan trafficking? What is that? I'm not familiar.
Yeah, so I think it's an organ trafficking, which is a small part of, well, there's organ and orphan. Organ trafficking, I don't know that I could take the stats and that I'm not as involved with that, but that is essentially what it sounds like. The connotations are pretty clear. It is somebody taking another person's life for their organs and then using them on the black market to, you know, a lung transfer, kidney, that sort of thing. It happens more often, I think, in Middle Eastern countries and India are where the stats are coming out of that. So I've had students do papers on that. I often encourage them. I say, if you are really grappling with what to write about and you don't know, let me encourage you to do this because this is an area I don't know a lot about and I like reading about it. And then orphan trafficking, that has been a common problem in countries like Asia, Russia, places where there's a high orphan crisis. And it's essentially smuggling orphans out of the country and then selling them through organizations, typically ones that aren't as reputable. We have a whole, I think it's the Hague organization that is supposed to run all of adoptions and make sure that they're legal and ethical. So I would imagine these are done behind closed doors, you know, behind the backs of people trying to really make sure that this isn't an ethical way to do adoption. And it is essentially taking orphans from other countries and selling them to other people. Most of the time, I think that they're sold to families, but sometimes they are sold to traffickers or to brothels. And either way, it's taking a child and selling them. And it's just the most unethical way to do an adoption.
Yeah, I mean, it's a vulnerable population, right? It's bound to be exploited by people. Wow. I appreciate you bringing up hope and all that stuff. Do you have some resources that you would send people to if they wanted to sort of know more about, I don't know, just anti-human trafficking and all that stuff? And I'll throw them in the show notes, but do you have some places just to
Yeah, so some of the ones that I've worked with that I can speak to them being reputable and great organizations. The A21 campaign, it is mostly kind of prevention and advocacy. They have a very youthful population, a very youthful demographic that they're reaching, but they're doing great work. The Freedom Climb, so this is a group of women that essentially, I want to say they raise $10,000 per person per climb. And they have done Mount Kilimanjaro. They have done the Grand Canyons. They will do these treks, these 3 or 4 day treks. I did Estes Park with them, spoke at it, and then did Estes Park. And they come, they raise the money, they raise awareness, and then they give it to different places that are doing rehabilitation mostly. So some places in Russia, some places in Russia that are doing human trafficking restoration, rehabilitation, and Unbound is an organization here in Waco. It's a parachurch ministry coming out of Antioch Community Church. And I want to say they've got about 30 locations throughout the U.S. and the globe. That's about how many church plants we have, and almost every church plant has an Unbound. And they work within the city. They are great at mobilizing a community. We've got a roundtable here in town where we've got law enforcement at it. We have people who are doing prevention. We have people who are doing, you know, prosecution, all coming together to say, what part can I play? And so a lot of the stings that we do, busting people who are selling others, are done out of this coalition and spearheaded by Unbound. Some of the prevention work that we're doing. So I would say if I were going to give three, it would be A21, Freedom Climb, and then Unbound. Those are good ones.
That's great. I appreciate that. Good stuff. I'll make sure and put that in the show notes for everybody. And it'll be some good resources. Okay, so where do we go next? Do you want to talk a little bit about just like being a professor and some of what that is? Because especially being interdisciplinary, is that, you know, does that raise issues for you, or, you know, switching back and forth between different disciplines or anything like that?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I would say that it does sometimes give me a bit of an identity crisis to be both in the English department and the School of Ed. The easier road to walk would have just been, you know, choose one little place and stick with it. I don't know. I'm still learning the Enneagram. I know I've listened to some of your podcasts and your big Enneagram, and I'm 95% sure I'm a three. But
I mean, I'm going to back you up on that, just knowing the little bit I know about you. But I can't say what your motivation is. You know?
That's true. That's true. You're not supposed to typecast or diagnose people. But I think I may have a four wing, though. When I look at kind of my core motivation, you know, sometimes I don't, can you flap with two wings? That's still up for debate, right? Whether you can be a two with a four wing, I don't know. But so I'm probably a three with a four wing. And I think for me, it just came down to making the decision long ago during my PhD program, even, where I'm not doing this. This is very anti-three thing to say, but I'm not really doing this to make a name for myself. I'm not doing that. I knew when I stepped off a tenure track position that there probably was no going back, particularly if I came back to Baylor, where it had granted me my PhD. It is very, very rare that sort of a research one, tier one university will give you a position on a tenure track. It just doesn't look very good for them. So I knew, okay, Lord, whatever I do from here, let it have meaning, let it have value, let it be kingdom minded. And if that means teaching, you know, writing courses in the English department, and then using that place of writing to say, you know, today we're going to talk about gender imbalance, and we do, or today we're going to talk about human trafficking, and we do. I think it's still a place of saying, I've got this voice, I've got this place of influence, and I'm going to use it here. And then within the School of Education, I'm not really as interested, not that there's anything wrong with people who want to look at different reading education programs or who are interested in measuring the growth of state testing. There's a need and a value for that. But nobody, I looked around the landscape and nobody was really doing human trafficking prevention. And I was passionate about it. So I said, okay, I'm going to use what clout and platform I have to do that through the School of Education. So I think, yeah, it has been hard to kind of be in two places, and it's been a little bit harder to be an expert on anything if you're spread across. But if you know you're not called to be an expert, but instead called just to be an influencer, then it sort of changes the rules of engagement. And I think that's kind of the touchstone I've gone back to. Am I doing this to be this platform expert, or am I doing this to have kingdom influence? And then it's not so bothersome to say, well, I teach English and education, and I do human trafficking work. Then I just look, yeah, very interdisciplinary rather than, yeah, than too broad.
No, I like that though. I like that your passions, your burdens really are driving how you go about your business. Yes. You know, I feel like especially in academia, I know a little bit about academia. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of professors, but like there's a serious, you know, need to perform, you know, especially on a tenure track, right? Like
right. Right. And I think this is the kind of work that I probably could not have even gotten tenured on. A colleague and I, from Baylor, who's in the School of Business, he and I were at a work and faith conference a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about that, that we're interested in this, and we want to know more about how do we integrate our faith into our work and make sure that the work we're doing really does have kingdom purpose and value. How do we equip other people to see that too? But it's such a soft field that it's not anything you could necessarily gain tenure on. And I would say human trafficking too, even though, you know, human trafficking prevention education is a little bit more of a social science, it's a little bit more concrete. It still is one of those places where it's so new and avant-garde that there's not a lot of space in academia to say, this is what I do for a living. This is what I do as my, you know, this is my place of research. It's just something you have to do in addition, unless you're willing to step off the tenure track and say, I actually just kind of teach here because I love teaching. And I actually do this research because I really believe in this research. Then suddenly the rules change and, you know, places like Baylor are like, okay, you go, girl. You know, so it just really, it gives a lot more freedom. So there are, you know, costs, but there are definitely gains, I think, too, with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know that I've ever heard it sort of put like that. I mean, you just have such a tangible example of what it looks like to sort of go about with your, you know, go with your passions and do what you're passionate about. It's, I really like that.
Yeah.
It also means that you could go to a conference speaking on any number of different things, right?
I mean, yeah. And I think maybe I have. I've talked about, you know, motherhood and work at conferences. I've talked about vocational calling at conferences. And I have definitely talked the most on human trafficking prevention education at conferences. So I think it does. It is this place. I think it helps to have a husband who's in business, who's constantly making snarky remarks about academia. You're like, what other field operates and you gain tenure and you never leave, you know, or, you know, it can be a very egocentric driven field if you let it be. But when you have somebody who's shining a light on that and saying, hey, you know, like you might, that field of, you know, influence might think that you're special, but in light of the rest of the world, you're like, okay, you're right. I'm not that special. So then, Lord, what do you want to do with me?
You got to love having a spouse that's a truth speaker. Like that is such a benefit, I think, yeah. You know, that's awesome. Okay. Well, let's jump into that other thing that you do and talking about faith and work, which is how I even sort of found you and, you know, that we connected on Instagram and all that stuff. So what is it? Do you mind explaining sort of what you do with faith and work and what that's looked like for you?
Sure. So I took an interest in this field first when I sometimes teach a course within leadership studies and it's on vocational leadership. So I'll teach an introduction to leadership, which is not explicitly faith oriented. You know, it's coming out of Christian University. So we do talk about faith and servant leadership. But the other course that I teach, the second semester of that is vocational leadership. So helping students discern what they're called to do. And it's really fascinating because they'll all say, you know, I feel called to teaching or I feel called to business or I feel called to social work. But then when you actually pause and say, if you feel called, who then is calling you? And there's just sort of this sacred moment where they reflect and wherever they are on that continuum, that spectrum of faith, they all recognize that, yes, there must be more of a supernatural element to this than I had previously thought. Wow, so we cool. spend the rest of the semester sort of wrestling through, reconciling, what does that mean to be called? How do you discern that? So we talk a little Enneagram, we talk some Myers-Briggs, we talk a lot about StrengthsFinders, things that they use at Baylor to help them be more self-actualized. And we do a lot of reading. And some of the reading that we do has come out of this faith and work movement. So I think that is then how I first took an interest in, well, there's this whole movement that Timothy Keller does, or Tom Nelson is another book we've used, Steve Garber. So a lot of these theologians who are giving my students a framework to think about, how do I carry my faith into the workplace? And they're not quite there yet, you know, as sophomores, juniors, they're working at Starbucks, they're, you know, kind of doing these places that they'll probably not continue on once they graduate. But it's helping them build a framework for when you do get out into the quote unquote real world, how then will you integrate your faith and your calling in a place that has influence, you know, kingdom influence, kingdom-minded work. And I think, you know, it's that in place of imposter syndrome, I was teaching this class for a while and then thinking, I don't know that I have a robust theology around this. Who can I look to that can teach me? And I'm big on authenticity. You know, I don't want to walk this out and just piecemeal it together. I really want to know for myself. I thought for a while I might be a 5 on the Enneagram for this very reason, but I needed to know. I needed to know. So I reached out to Dallas Theological Seminary, had some connections there, and was connected through them. And they, you know, kind of mutually said, let's do a fellowship. And they have an entire center on work, faith, leadership. And I've spent the last year, I'm spending this year rather shadowing them, doing some writing with them, some podcasts for them. I'm going to conferences like Work and Faith to really, again, build a more robust theological framework for what does that mean to engage our career and our faith, and why does it matter?
That's good stuff. So, I mean, I have to ask, what are some of the things that you have been understanding, or where do you feel like maybe there was a lack of understanding before?
Specifically within work and faith? So one of the things I noticed as I'm teaching my students, I struggled with, this feels really elitist to say, you've been given this privilege and you've been given this place of influence. And because you're a believer, that, you know, sort of that idea of to whom much has been given, much is expected, which is, it's very biblical, but it also feels very elitist at times. So one of the things I noticed with this conference, Work and Faith conference I went to a couple of weeks ago, they made concerted efforts to expand their conversation to include minorities, women, and people who are in what we would traditionally call blue-collar fields to be part of the conversation. Because historically, I think this has been more of a white male, white-collar conversation. And I have felt that even from my little place in Waco, Texas, I'm teaching my students, and that is the demographic primarily that I'm speaking to. I mean, my classrooms are kind of racially diverse, but they're not necessarily socioeconomically diverse. And these kids are definitely going to go on to fields of influence. And so it just felt really elitist to say this discussion only applies to you, because that is not the rest of theology. I mean, the gospel narrative applies to everybody. And I didn't necessarily feel that with this field. I was encouraged after the conference that they're essentially saying, we've got to do something about this problem, and we need to, you know, figure out what our framework is so that this is more inclusive. It's got to be more than just essentially dominion, and it's got to be more communion. And the conversation has historically been, how do we stretch out our tent pegs and widen our reach and, you know, sort of climb, 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 earn, and gain dominion? Which in a sense is part of the narrative. You know, it's, you know, the creation, fall, redemption, restoration. It's the building, building, building. But what is missed in that, or what is not emphasized enough, was communion. And one of the things one of the speakers said, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, we talk a lot about being a city on a hill, but we don't talk enough about how the story ends in a banquet, a wedding banquet in which all are invited. And I think that that sort of nailed it for me, that the work and faith movement is saying, okay, yes, we want to be a city on the hill. Yes, we want to have dominion and influence, but we cannot exalt this line of thinking over, please come sit at my table. All are invited. All are welcome. This is communion and breaking of bread.
Yeah, that's good. I'm just sort of processing that even now.
Yeah.
That's good stuff. I do feel like that gets lost in the conversation quite a bit. I mean, our Western world has been classically so white male dominated anyway, right? Who wouldn't think that this conversation would be a part of that?
Right.
To a large extent, right?
Yeah. And church circles too have predominantly been, you know, white male evangelical. But I'm proud of the movement for pausing and saying, wait, whoa, we need to be more inclusive here. So.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. That's good stuff. Very good stuff.
This is kind of funny. I don't know if you want to include this, but the other day I was having a conversation with my husband about coming on the podcast and the theology of hustle. And he pointed out to me, he said, you've always said that you don't like the word hustle and that you don't like the connotations of, you know, hustler. And I said, you know, that's true. It still probably holds true, but I love that this podcast is redeeming that. It's pairing this idea of not just hustling for the sake of getting ahead. And again, going back to your, you know, building your dominion, but it is this place of saying, okay, I want to walk this out with holiness. So how then can I do things that are not just for God, but with God? It really highlights that place of communion, that holy hustle. I mean, you can't walk things out with humility or holiness if you're not abiding. And I think I love that about the pairing, the juxtaposition of those two words, holy hustle, that it sort of redeems any of the negative connotations I've had about hustle. So I liked that.
I definitely appreciate that. I don't know that I've actually talked about a lot of that, like the reason behind most of this stuff on the podcast.
Yeah.
Probably something I should do at some point, but right. But yeah. It is like I do. I have a fascination with the hip hop culture anyway. You would not know that about me, but I love hip hop. I love underground hip hop. And I love the social change that it can bring and all of that. I feel like it's a misunderstood movement by white people, basically.
Yeah.
They don't understand that rap wasn't about just like all this. Sorry, I'm totally on a soapbox.
No, I love it. I'm fascinated.
People don't understand that this rap wasn't all about just like women and yachts and like gangster stuff, but it was from the very beginning about social change and that there were minorities that felt like they did not have a voice in their world.
Yeah.
And so they used their art
to
showcase what's going on. Like, so I'm trying to marry this like high end, high theology where we're not afraid of like talking about really really academically astute things, but in a way that makes them like super practical, right? Like the hustle is it's the nitty gritty. It's the down to earth. Like, let's take this high theology that's academic and like give it to people who can actually use it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me of the emerging field with, you know, practical theology. It's this layman's theology. And, you know, yes, sometimes theologians snub their nose at that, but it is this sort of rebuttal, this refute to that. The rest of us want something that feels tangible that we can actually then implement and integrate. And that feels like, I think social change. You want it to be less heady and more practical. And so I think I sense that too with the theology of hustle, but it does. It also feels really redemptive. I think, you know, hustle just can have negative connotations, but paired with and juxtaposed to holy hustle, it feels like you've redeemed what has been otherwise, I think, lost in maybe its original intent, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we all got to make it, right? Like, we all got to make money. We all got to live and survive, right? But how are we going to choose to do that? Like, in the most self-aggrandizing way possible, or in a way that glorifies God with everything?
The holiest way possible.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much so. Yeah. I really appreciate that. Thanks for talking that through with me and standing by my soapbox there.
No, I love that. I'm a researcher. I'm always interested. I love that. Your history.
I think too, for theologians that are afraid or scared of making something practical, that they don't understand their theology that well. Like, if you have to use what you do in order to sort of prop yourself up, then you're missing it. I think. So
that's a good point.
Anyway, good. Well, thank you for that discussion. And I appreciate it. It's always nice when somebody catches the vision, because a lot of times when you're podcasting, it feels like you're sort of out on this island and like putting stuff out and not sure if anybody even cares. Right?
Yeah. So, yeah. No, I've been listening to some of the, which is how I know that you're a big Enneagram person, but some of the podcasts. And I particularly loved Annie's from was it on Monday? The bookstore owner.
Oh, it came out today.
Okay. Oh, well, I was
going to say. You are not messing around.
I didn't know it came out today, but I did listen to it during my workout today. So that's funny.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're on the cutting edge of that. Yeah. She did a great job.
Yeah.
I thought.
Yes, she did.
You should follow her. She has a whole sphere. I mean, that bookstore has 10,000 people following it.
Bookshelf. Yeah. Okay.
And what she's doing, I think, is revolutionary to like a small business model for something like that.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, thanks for being a supporter. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I love following you on Instagram, actually. So maybe if I could just tell you that. Like, I always watch your stories. I think what you're doing is it's good stuff.
Oh, so, thanks. Yeah, I don't know that I have a ton of strategy behind it. I just had a conversation with a friend this morning who was like, you know, some people hire people to help them hone. Then I'm like, gosh, I just don't know. It doesn't feel real authentic, and I'm not there yet. You know, maybe someday I will be, but right now this is just me. Like, here's my Halloween pictures and here's my rant about how, you know, the feminist movement has made space for you to go back to work and stay home with your kids. So I, you know, I'm kind of more, what am I thinking today? Not a lot of strategy.
No, I like that. It drives me. Yeah. Maybe we're more alike. Like, you might be a three with a four wing, or I might be, or something. That whole authenticity thing is like, or maybe it's like a generational thing or whatever, but yeah. I'm the same way. Like, I don't want, yeah, fake stuff, or, you know, I want it to be me. And
so, yes. Yeah.
Sorry. I could pick your brain about all of this stuff, all day. I know you probably have stuff you need to get to, but.
Okay. You said you had two more questions. I want to make sure
I have two more questions. Yes. Yes. My final two questions. So are you ready for it?
I'm ready. Yes.
Okay. So first, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
The strangest job I've ever had. Well, I don't know that this was so strange, other than this just was not a me fit. But I was a lifeguard in high school, and I just felt greasy for me. You know, I think things have changed a little bit. I've taken my kids to water park, but, you know, like, the swimsuits were just so revealing, and it just felt like, I don't know, it was a very sexist environment, and to be 16 and sort of thrown into that felt just kind of weird and greasy. And then I went from there. I had a connection through the water park, you know, like, things that you don't discern at the tender age of 16, to working at a tanning bed salon, you know? And so I don't know where my parents were on that. If they weren't like, hey, let's help you hone your, you know, your summer side hustles here. But yeah, so going from lifeguard, which in itself wasn't such a weird thing to do, it just felt like a weird environment. And then from there, the next summer, I worked in a tanning salon. You know, so that was, I don't even think, do we have tanning salons anymore? Do those exist?
I think there still are. I think they're still around. Yeah, yes, like, I believe so.
Yeah, the correlation between tanning and cancer is quite high. Maybe we've shut those down for the most part. But those are probably the strangest jobs I've ever had. Lifeguard isn't so strange. It was a strange environment. But then the tanning bed salon, whatever I was. Hostess?
No, I definitely receive that lifeguard thing, because I think we don't talk enough about all that culture that happens in the lifeguard world, because it really is, it can be very strange.
Yeah, putting 16-year-old girls in swimsuits and having them kind of parade around and sit on the stand. And
They're literally on a pedestal.
Yes.
Right? Like,
I mean, well, and I think we've, you know, again, grown, I think, within the feminist movement on this. And I think I've seen now some girls who are in shorts and a little bit more modest, I'm assuming by their choosing. But I think even the catcalls that you would get from the dads of kids, and, you know, there was no boundaries. There were no protection around that. And I know there are other industries where that takes place. But I just remember entering and you're like, I'm a lifeguard. What's the big deal about this? And you get entered and you're like, whoa, this is a whole subculture. And I didn't realize I was signing up for this as a high school kid. So that was strange.
I just have to go back to, you legit got catcalled by
dads? Yeah.
No.
So, yeah, I know. And, you know, and I was a baby. I'm a kid myself. And yeah, so again, I think that's a place where now, it's not that that wouldn't happen, but I think just people around would stick up for you, or your manager would say something. And that wasn't necessarily the case, you know, back in the late 90s, early 2000s. So, yeah.
Can I just say I'm sorry for that, because
well, thank you. I've had some inner healing. I'm fine now.
Okay. I don't even know. It's so skeezy. Anyway, maybe that's like the roots of like your human trafficking, like maybe anti-human trafficking, you know, like just feeling that. Anyway, we don't need to psychologize too much, right?
Yes.
Right. Okay. So then finally, what one piece of advice would you give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their vocation?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. I think the first place to start with that is that you don't have to make any huge life changes. That sounds like such a grandiose call and be just such big shoes to fill, but helping people see that right within where you are is a good place to start. You know, I've heard Jenny Allen, she's, you know, kind of an acquaintance of mine, and follow her on Instagram, and she runs the If Gathering. And she has talked a lot about, if you want to build a discipleship movement, then you start by discipling that one person who is right in front of you. And I think that helps take the focus off of, you know, two things. One, yourself, you know, that it has to be big and it has to be important for you to do it. And then I think too, it just helps gives you a heart for the small things, that the Lord is in the small things and he entrusts the small things to you before he will give you the big things. He wants to see you steward that well first. So I would say, again, just looking around and asking yourself, where can I be salt and light within what I have to do today and tomorrow and the next day? I think a great example of this would be, recently my husband has had to do a lot of hiring, a lot of HR work within his company. And he was, you know, kind of came down to these two candidates to be his intern. He's hiring these students from Baylor. And he says, you know, this one guy, they're both equally qualified, but this one guy just seems hungry for mentorship and discipleship. Mm. He wants me to pour into him. And he made that conscious decision that I'm going to take this guy on as a mentor, that I'm going to, you know, teach him not just how to do spreadsheets or to do, you know, ROI, return on investment, or all the other things that he's teaching in his business world. I learned a new term the other day, BATNA, best alternative to negotiated agreement. You know, so, wow. So I know, that's, I don't really know what context to use that in, but I just know it. So I think it's sort of saying, okay, who's hungry, who's asking for the mentorship, who's asking for the discipleship. And then even in that business context, taking him to lunch, how's your life do, you know, how's your life, how, you know, asking the spiritual deep questions as well. Just kind of getting in the fray with people there, I think could be a really tangible way of saying, I want to usher the kingdom into the sphere of influence. I think another way that anybody can to integrate, again, you know, faith and work, as looking for places of brokenness where there needs to be justice. So for me, it might look at like using my research to do human trafficking prevention advocacy. I think for another student, it might look, you know, a student of mine recently just ran for class president. And I want to say he might be, well, I might get this wrong, but he's essentially one of the first African-American or minority presidents that I think has ever been student class president. Or he was telling me essentially something like this. He said, I looked out and I said, I have a heart for this. I want to do student government and leadership. And it's just not right that an African-American has never fulfilled this position before, whatever that particular position was. And I want to run sort of on this platform that you've got room at the table too, even if you don't look like maybe the majority of the student body, you still have a voice. And I think that's a great place of bringing kingdom redemption into a place that needed to be shaken up a little bit.
That's, I love that. That's really good advice. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks. Well, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, this was, Carrie. I feel like we're friends now and we should do this like every couple of months or something.
We'll just get on.
And that's Zoom chat.
I'm totally down.
Well, it was great chatting with you.
Yeah, you too. I know we'll probably run across each other. If I'm ever in Waco again,
yeah,
I'll for sure look you up.
So. Yeah. I mean, everyone takes a pilgrimage here at some point. You know, it's like you got to make your stops at Bethel and Waco, Texas. You know, if you know, there's evangelical stops. So let me know if you're ever here.
Okay, we'll do. Okay. Hopefully we'll see each other around.
Okay, right? Sounds good. Have a great day, Curry.
Thanks.
Okay.
You too.
Bye.
What a great discussion, right? Just about somebody who wears a lot of hats but is just so driven by their passions. And I just love her story and just why she does what she does. It inspires me to pursue my passions in greater ways. And so I hope you really enjoyed hearing from Christina, hearing a little bit more about the theology of hustle and what I got going on here. If you can, make sure you're subscribed so you get future episodes. I've got some incredible people coming up, so you are not going to want to miss all of those. Make sure you're subscribed. You can follow me on Instagram at Theology of Hustle. Just to stay up to date with what I got going on. And until next time, get out there and hustle.